The following program is intended for an audience of blind and print-impaired listeners and is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm John Federson, and that program is The Independent Indie Week, a weekly journal from the Triangle and surrounding areas. And it's produced by the NC Reading Service, and we record on Thursday. So the current issue from Indie Week is December the 5th of 2024. I think that's my boilerplate for the day, and so the next thing you'll hear is me reading the Indie Week like I'm supposed to. Here we go. And there are three news articles concerning basically the city and county of Durham. And I'll start with those. This County Board of Commissioners has been officially sworn into office. The winners of the Board of County Commissioners race is a foregone conclusion after the March primary, but that didn't make this week's swearing-in ceremony any less emotional for the incoming members. Inside the county meeting room early Monday morning, family, friends, council members, school board members, and other elected officials filled the aisles to recognize three new commissioners, Michelle Burton, Stephen Valentine, and Mike Lee, and two incumbents, current board chair Nita Allam and longtime commissioner Wendy Jacobs, who were all officially sworn into their positions. Sharon Davis was also reelected to a third term as Durham County Register of Deeds. Jacobs is now the senior county commissioner with the departure of Brenda Howerton. During her remarks, she paid homage to Ellen Reckow, who was the senior member of the board when Jacobs was first elected 12 years ago. Jacobs was emotional as she reflected on her time within county government, saying she has grown as a listener and plans to keep learning from her colleagues and constituents. She said, choking up as she spoke, I will continue to strive to be the best leader I can be for the people of Durham and this community that I love so deeply. In recent years, she's governed through the unceremonious ousting of two county managers, Wendell Davis and Kimberly Sowell, and the challenges of the COVID pandemic. But that hasn't deterred her from embracing the responsibilities of county government. With uncertainty ahead at the federal level, Jacobs is looking inward toward the Durham community for solidarity, saying, "This fight may be harder in the days ahead. I believe that here in Durham we are up to the challenge, and I know I still have the fire in my belly for this fight." Stephen Valentine brought his own fiery disposition to the ceremony, speaking with vigor, perhaps a byproduct of his military background as a U.S. Army veteran. He now works as a social worker and teaches veterans law at North Carolina Central University. During his campaign, Valentine said he wants to use his experience as a social worker and veteran to curb gun violence in Durham and support the county's health service outcomes, saying, "I treasure this awesome responsibility and the trust you have reposed in me. I still believe that government is a vehicle for positive change in our community when we put people first." Lee and Burton come with years of experience working in local education. Lee served on the school board from 2012 to 2020, serving as the chair for 4 years. Burton spent her career in education working as a school librarian for decades. She also has been a member of the North Carolina Association of Educators since 1995 and served as president of the Durham Association of Educators from 2019 to 2023. Durham County plays an integral part in funding local education. Last year, the county awarded Durham Public Schools an additional $27 million funding supplement, the largest in county history. Lee and Burton will bring valuable insight to the board's negotiations with DPS for future funding. At the swearing-in ceremony, Burton called out the North Carolina General Assembly for what she described as an erosion of resources for public schools. Quote, "We are dealing with a legislature that is bent on destroying public education," she said. But it was not the only pressing issue for Burton. Quote, "We know that housing costs are unaffordable and out of reach for many of our residents, and many of our residents' mental health is suffering due to these economic pressures, but I remain hopeful. As Durhamites, we have always come together to figure out how to solve these complex issues, to continue to make Durham one of the best places to live in our state and in our country." Lee, whose colleagues elected him vice chair of the board, followed Burton. After thanking his family and friends, Lee shared the news that he had been diagnosed with prostate cancer in June. Lee said doctors caught the cancer in time to leave him cancer-free after surgery. He implored the audience to check in with older males in their lives to get screened for prostate cancer, a common cancer for men over 40. Quote, "I want Durham to be the most PSA-tested county in the nation," he said through a grin. Alam was the last to give remarks. She gave a heartfelt tribute to her friends Dia, Yusor, and Razan, three Muslim American students from UNC Chapel Hill and NC State who were murdered in 2015 in Chapel Hill. And she said, "Their legacy is a constant reminder of what it means to be a proud Muslim American. Their lives embodied love, service, and community, and I carry that legacy and their memory with me in everything I do. They inspire me to lead with purpose and to dedicate my service in honoring their light." Alam, who was reelected as chair of the Board of Commissioners, was the first Muslim woman in North Carolina elected to public office in 2020. Alam said she is ready to offer guidance to the new elected officials in the way that Jacobs and other commissioners helped mentor her. She welcomed the new commissioners into the Durham County family, an organization which consists of more than 2,000 people, as she held her daughter in her lap, saying, "I know they will accept you and love you as their own family. Lean on them. Support them. Show them the love and gratitude that they so rightfully deserve." The board will hold its last regular session coming up on December 9th. Before going on break until the new year. Well, next we have an article about a bus driver shortage for the schools in Durham. The school board's New Year's resolution, get kids to school. At a special meeting on Monday, the board discussed two new strategies to tackle the ongoing school bus driver shortage: family responsibility zones and express bus stops, which DPS Transportation Services hopes to implement this coming January, within a month. The new zones and stops are the latest proposals to resolve the bus crisis. They follow a recent decision to implement a rotational bus service in which families are responsible for transporting their children to school one day per week through the end of this month, December. Under the Family Responsibility Zone plan, the district would no longer provide bus transport for students who live within a 1.5-mile radius of 21 elementary schools. Instead, families living within those zones would be responsible for getting their children to school. The district estimates the zones would impact about 1,000 families. Matthew Palmer, the school system senior director of school planning and operational services, said his team has examined the zones in fine-grained detail, looking at sidewalks, traffic lights, and road speeds to identify where the plan could safely be implemented. The names of the 21 elementary schools that would be affected by the new zones have not yet been made public. Palmer also proposed new express bus stops for students attending Durham School of the Arts, Rogers Herr Middle School, and the School for Creative Studies, saying on Monday, "So an express bus stop is asking the families to arrive at their nearest school and from that location receive shuttle or express service directly from that site into the school they're attending. These new stops would impact an estimated 1,100 riders and 8 school bus routes." Board members voiced support for the two options but emphasized the need for clear communication with parents. Board member Bettine Umsted said, "When families signed up for the schools, they signed up for transportation. The district's communication about the buses has been a sticking point for parents. At a board meeting on November 21, DPS parent Kelly Riley urged the district to be more open in its communication with the public, saying, "The newsletters and things that we get, we're being told it's a problem. We already know it's a problem. So what I would like to hear in your communication is what you're doing about it." Additionally, parents have raised concerns about the EduLog parent portal. That's a bus tracking app used to give parents notice about delayed and canceled routes. Anna Garcia is a parent of a sixth grader at Brogdon Middle, and she said in an interview, "So, for example, if a 12-year-old doesn't have a phone or an app, they wouldn't know, so they'll be waiting forever at the bus stop." Many students in her apartment complex catch the school bus at a nearby stop on LaSalle Street. But Garcia said that stop is problematic. Quote, "The bus stop site is hazardous. There's no shelter to take cover in case of an emergency." Also noting that many children in her apartment complex community end up taking city buses to get to school. At the Monday meeting, Sheena Cooper, the system's senior director of public affairs, said the district is working to be strategic about its communication regarding the two new options. Quote, "We will make sure we have a plan that speaks to all of those that will be impacted by this, so all of their questions are answered, and whatever direction we take in the new year, that everyone is on the same page." The board and transport services discussed January 22nd as a possible start date for this family responsibility zone and express bus stops. The board is expected to continue discussing these proposals at its meeting coming up on December the 19th. Next, at a rainy rally, advocates slam Durham's foster care system. "Shame, quit your job." A crowd of about 30 Durham advocates chanted those words at the Durham County Department of Social Services doorstep on Wednesday as part of the Stop Family Policing Rally. Stop Family Policing Rally. In response to the noise, employees on the third floor pulled shut their gray blinds. That gathering was organized by Operation Stop CPS, the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, and the Civil Rights Corps. In Wednesday's steady rain, the activists held umbrellas over one another and marched between DSS and the Durham County Courthouse. Yankee Canaria of the Southern Coalition for Social Justice explained the protesters' intent. "We are part of a movement here in Durham, North Carolina, and nationally that is calling for an overhaul of the family policing system. The existing foster care system disproportionately impacts Black Durham residents," said the organizers. "In 2022, Black families comprised 36% of the population in the county, but accounted for 64% of the Child Protective Service investigations. According to Emancipate NC, that's a nonprofit, focused on criminal justice reform. According to a report in the Assembly newspaper, Durham County's rate of reunifying families is 22%, well below the national rate. In an email response, Pamela Purfoy, senior public information officer for the Durham County Department of Social Services, defended the department's record, quote, "Our staff works tirelessly to ensure the safety of children that come into our care through very difficult circumstances. Every effort is made by our agency to maintain and strengthen family bonds, specifically with our in-home care program. Our agency adheres to all North Carolina statutes regarding our foster care program." Other speakers had pointed critiques for Durham County District Court Judge Doretta Walker, one of the two judges presiding over the Durham court that determines foster care placements and family reunifications. Elizabeth Rossi of the Civil Rights Corps, that's a District of Columbia-based legal advocacy group, criticized Judge Walker's role in abuse, neglect, and dependency proceedings. On November 13th, the Corps filed a lawsuit against Judge Walker and Durham County Sheriff Clarence Burkhead. That suit accuses Walker and Burkhead of routinely preventing court watchers from observing such hearings and charges that doing so violates citizens' First Amendment rights. Judge Walker and Sheriff Burkhead didn't comment or couldn't be reached for comment. In an interview after the rally, Rossi explained such hearings were invaluable to evidence building in previous cases of wrongdoing, such as cases that the Civil Rights Corps pursued in Tennessee against private probation companies. And she said, "By sitting in those courtrooms, I could see the relationship between the private probation company and the judges and prosecutors, because you can see them talking." The rally also featured first-hand accounts of the foster care system from Cheryl Smith, a Durham foster and adoptive mother, and Rafiq Zaidi, a Durham resident and president of the community group Black Concerned Citizens. Zaidi entered the foster care system at age 5 and attributes its instability to his later 44 juvenile felony charges. As they wrapped up, protesters marched toward the courthouse bearing a large banner labeled "Stop Kidnapping Black Children." All right, our longest article in this week's IndieWeek, Raleigh Law Firm. Join forces to pursue civil lawsuit against North Carolina State and Monsanto. Four law practices jointly pursuing the civil lawsuit against North Carolina State University and Monsanto say the university's lack of transparency has failed to deliver answers to people who worked and studied in Poe Hall, a building suspected of being linked to hundreds of cancer cases and other illnesses. Attorney Pat Wallace, a partner at Milberg, said, "There's always more to the story than what is being let on, so that's why it's so important that more documents come to light." Apparently that's one of the firms that has joined with this lawsuit. The firm said they are representing hundreds of clients who believe they've developed cancer or another illness from exposure to polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, in Poe Hall. In a recent interview, attorneys from the four practices, Milberg, Whitley, Edwards, Kirby, and the law offices of F. Baron Bryce, Jr., said they decided to join forces to pool resources. Attorney Ben Whitley said, "Not only are we pursuing claims against a major institution, backed by the state of North Carolina, were also pursuing claims against a multi-billion-dollar corporation. PCBs, I'm old enough to remember those, were commonly used and manufactured in the United States from 1929 until 1979, when they were banned by the Toxic Substances Control Act. Monsanto, an agrochemical company acquired by Bayer in 2018, manufactured the building materials used to construct Pohol in 1971. State closed Pohol after university leaders became aware of a safety complaint filed with the state's Department of Labor's Occupational Safe and Health Division, as well as, quote, concerns that employees may have been exposed to other hazardous substances due to the building's age and ongoing renovation projects. That's according to a timeline put together by NC State. Following reports of the complaint tests conducted by NC State's Environmental Health and Safety Division, EHS, in October of 2023 found detectable levels of commercial PCB compound aerochlor-1262 in samples taken from Poe, according to the university. They contacted the NC Department of Health and Human Services for further guidance, and the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH, to request a health hazard evaluation. The building was closed November 17th in 2023 after the university's leaders, quote, promptly decided to proactively close the building to better understand what potential issues exist, according to state's Pohol Updates website. The firms pursuing the case are still in the preliminary stages of research. Legal action could begin as early as next year. Bryce and Wallace said they have begun investigating other buildings on NC State's campus and plan to extend their investigation to buildings across the University of North Carolina system. Records from caulk testing in 2018 revealed that manufactured PCB compounds, aerochlor-1254 and 1268, were present in high concentration in exterior panels and windows of Pohol that ranged from 2,700 to 6,000 parts per million and 12 to 17,000 parts per million, respectively. EPA recommends the removal of PCBs found in building materials greater than or equal to 50 ppm. So instead of 50, we're talking over 2,500 to 6,000 and 12,000 to 17,000 parts per million. Records also show that high concentrations of PCBs were found in sections of the exterior caulking of D.H. Hill Library in 2018 and Dabney Hall in 23. Some sections of exterior caulk on Dabney Hall exceeded recommendations by 40 to 400 times, while areas of the library 76 to 400 times higher than EPA designated safe levels. During a webinar held March 25th this year, Chancellor Randy Woodson said that NC State maintenance or renovation personnel may choose to test building materials suspected to contain PCBs before maintenance or renovation, even though EPA guidelines do not require building testing before construction. Woodson said, if there are maintenance issues or if individuals express concerns, our facilities and environmental health and safety team will evaluate these as they have always done in the past. When contacted for an interview, Woodson referred requests for comment to the NC State EHS, which Director Mary Beth Koza responded to in a written statement, quote, testing buildings for hazardous substances may be routinely conducted when building renovation projects are undertaken depending on the age of the building and material being disturbed as part of the project. The regulatory requirements regarding hazardous substance assessment, mitigation, and remediation guide our response. According to a PCB's Q&A document published by the EPA in 2015, caulk containing high levels of PCBs can release those chemicals into the air through a process called off-gassing. Additionally, PCBs can leach into surrounding materials like wood, concrete, and other types of masonry. Attorney Brian Bryce said his law firm learned about the magnitude of the Pohol situation after receiving a large volume of calls beginning in December of 23 from people who had formerly studied at Pohol and had been or were currently diagnosed with cancer and other neurological issues. He said the university's decision not to contact past students or faculty of Pohol has contributed to a lack of transparency. Quote, "It was disappointing to say the least to us to see NC State higher-ups go to the General Assembly and ask for $180 million to fix a building, but not a penny to help the people who are sick." In the March webinar, Provost Warwick Arden said the university is following NIOSH's lead with the health hazard evaluation in terms of outreach and gathering information. One of Bryce's earlier clients, Darren Mazira, received a doctorate in education from State in 2013 and was later diagnosed with cancer. His case was appealed to the State Supreme Court, which ruled to allow independent testing inside Pohol in June of this year. Wallace said results from the firm's expert will provide an unbiased picture of the Pohol environment, independent of Monsanto or the university's interest. Before that state ruling, the only testing allowed in Poh was commissioned by the university and performed by the consulting and engineering firm Geosyntec in February of this year. Wallace said the Geosyntec report was a, quote, "nothing to see here" type of report. Wallace said, "While they're saying nothing to see here, there's no problems, they've also permanently closed Pohol and talk about spending hundreds of millions of dollars to remediate it. So there's obviously something amiss with those two stories." Sandy Alford studied inside Pohol from the fall of 1989 till the spring of 1992 when she received her master's in education. She spent an additional two semesters pursuing a doctorate in 1996 in the same building before discontinuing her study. Around Thanksgiving of 2021, Alford was diagnosed with stage 2 metastatic breast cancer. Dressed in pink, with a breast cancer awareness pin on her lapel, Alford regularly comes to the building to put up breast cancer stickers and caution students who sit at the chairs and tables next to the building, telling them not to risk their health. She said she wonders if university administrators would have taken different steps if Pohol was not a building of predominantly female educators, saying, "If this was an engineering school, if this was an MBA school, if this was a male-dominated building, would it be different?" Women in Alford's program would frequently need to bring their children to class, she said, her voice breaking. "It was just a bunch of women trying to help a bunch of other women get through this as best they could. If that meant bringing their kid to class, we didn't care." She recounted one woman who had to bring her baby to the final exam and breastfeed in the building, saying, "Now, looking back on that decision, it breaks my heart because the university isn't tracking us, so I know they're not tracking those children." Since learning about the presence of PCBs in Pohol, Alford has been working to connect others with information about the impact of PCBs on the body and spread the word to other Poe Hall alumni who have been diagnosed with cancer or other illnesses. When Alford had genetic testing done to determine if her breast cancer was hereditary, it came back negative. Back in February, Alford went on WRAL with a panel of seven other women who were diagnosed with different types of cancers, including breast cancer. All had attended Poe Hall. "We all had DNA testing done," said Alford. "Everybody's DNA came back negative." The EPA has classified these PCBs as probable human carcinogens following a reassessment of a 1987 study. The agency's review of all relevant animal studies found clear evidence that PCBs cause cancer in animals and have toxic effects on the immune, reproductive, nervous, and endocrine systems. The National Toxicology Program has said it's reasonable to conclude that PCBs are carcinogenic in humans, and NIOSH has concluded that PCBs are a potential occupational carcinogen. Alford said the alumni of Poe Hall don't have a leg to stand on because they don't have the same protections as staff and faculty under these OSHA regulations. Alford said, "We've been called drama queens. We've been called liars. We've been told we're just standing around waiting for a paycheck." The NCSU Center for Community Action and Environmental Justice, CCAEJ, delivered a petition November 19th to Holiday Hall, the location of the Chancellor's office. Ava Dandurand, an undergrad student involved with CCAEJ, said they taped the 34-page document to the door while holding up signs and chanting outside the building. Dandurand said students deserve to know if they're going into a building that has PCBs in it, saying, "It's disheartening because my parents send me off to school thinking I'm going to be safe. I should be safe going to class. I should be safe in my dorm." "Most students know about Poe Hall," she said, "but few realize PCBs have been found on other campus buildings." Dandurand often has classes in Dabney Hall and said she chooses to avoid the building as much as possible or wear a mask, saying their number one priority should be human health. Why they care more about buildings and money over us and our health, I will never understand that. Chelsea Lundquist-Wentz is a grad student and instructor at NC State who helped to organize the university's chapter of CCAEJ. The organization's demands to the university, she said, are to contact all former employees and students who were exposed to Poe Hall's environment, compensate those people for health screenings, and investigate the presence of PCBs in other buildings on the university campus. Lundquist winced, said a lack of transparency and action have also been main concerns for the group. She's saying the complaints that were filed within the university, they've essentially never responded to them. Now, COSA said in the statement, "If we have reason to believe a building is unsafe or in need of repair, we will take action to protect the safety of our community. Every concern submitted to the university, triaged, and responded to by a team of campus partners as appropriate in the circumstances." Now, the CDC defines a cancer cluster as a greater than expected number of related cancer cases that occurs within a group of people in a geographic area over a defined period of time. In a March webinar, Arden said no federal or state agency investigations have found evidence that there is a cancer center related to Poe Hall. Andrew Olshan, a UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health professor in cancer epidemiology, said it's difficult to replicate the methodology of, quote, gold standards epidemiology studies that can control for various factors and clearly show causation. And he said, you will see cancers of different types that can occur. The challenge is trying to tease out, is there a particular risk factor in the environment, in the building, or wherever, that is specifically associated with specific cancer or cancer types? Olshan said the same type of cancer can have multiple etiologic pathways, making it hard to determine the cause. Oral cancer, for example, can be caused by smoking, but also human papillomavirus. In a 2012 study by Emory University epidemiologist Michael Goodman and his colleagues, 428 cancer cluster investigations in 38 different states were examined over 20 years. The most commonly reported cancer types observed in the study were leukemia, breast, and brain cancers. However, only one investigation identifies a cause of those cancers with certainty. As that Goodman study shows, Olshan said, finding clear causation in occupational settings is difficult because the varying levels to which different individuals have different exposure levels to a toxin in the environment. These are legitimate concerns, said Olshan. Are there adverse health outcomes to being in that community or working in that building? And they deserve an answer. It's just that the answers are often hard. More legal action now of a slightly different sort. The town of Carrboro is suing Duke Energy for climate deception. A small town in North Carolina has taken a bold step, filing the first climate deception lawsuit against an electric utility in the United States. In a civil lawsuit, the town council of Carrboro accuses Duke Energy, one of the largest power companies in the United States, of orchestrating a decades-long campaign of denialism and cover-up over the dangers of fossil fuel emissions. The lawsuit claims Duke's actions stalled the transition to clean energy and exacerbated the climate crisis. Over the past decade, similar suits have been filed by states and communities against large oil companies and, in at least one instance, a gas utility. But Carrboro, the first municipality to ever file such a suit against an electric utility. Carrboro Mayor Barbara Fouché said, we're a very bold group, and we know how urgent this climate crisis is. Duke Energy did not immediately respond to a request for comment about the lawsuit. The suit, filed in Orange County, accuses Duke Energy of intentionally spreading false information about the negative effects of fossil fuels for decades. Despite knowing since the late 1960s about planet-warming properties of carbon dioxide emissions. It claims the power company funded trade organizations and climate-skeptic scientists who created doubts about the greenhouse effect and obstructed policy and public action on climate change. The lawsuit reads, quote, Duke misled the public concerning the causes and consequences of climate change and thereby materially slowed the transition away from fossil fuels and toward renewable energy. Duke's deception campaign served to protect its fossil fuel-based business model. It accuses the power company, which in 2019 was the third largest emitter of CO2 in the United States, of falsely marketing itself as a leader in clean energy while continuing to rely heavily on fossil fuels. Between 2005 and 2023, the company reported reducing its CO2 emissions from electricity generation by 44%. But in 2023, at least 45% of the electricity Duke produced was still generated by burning coal or methane gas. Raleigh attorney Matthew Quinn, who represents the town in this suit, says Duke was one of the ringleaders behind deceiving the public and municipalities and governments about the causes and consequences of man-made climate change. Carrboro is a town of about 20,000 with an annual budget of $81 million, said Fouché. Quinn, attorney, estimates the town will incur some $60 million in costs in adapting to climate change impacts, including repairs to roads, upgrades to stormwater systems, and increased heating and cooling costs. And says, really, what this case is about is that Carrboro has been a victim of the climate deception campaign by Duke Energy, and a result of a Duke's conduct, Carrboro has suffered a lot of damages and injustice. Quinn's fees are being paid by N.C. Warren, W-A-R-N. N.C. Warren, a climate nonprofit, said the mayor. Jim Warren, executive director of N.C. Warren, says people that run local governments and others and people that run corporations, they all better get heavily serious about this climate crisis. It's already harming so many across this state. Although this is the first climate deception lawsuit ever filed against an electric utility, it's not the first time that electric utilities have found themselves in legal trouble for the climate warming pollution their power plants spew as they burn fossil fuels to generate electricity. In 2004, electric companies faced federal litigation brought by eight U.S. states, New York City, and several land trusts seeking to cap the company's CO2 emissions. The U.S. Supreme Court ultimately unanimously ruled against the plaintiffs. Let's move to the everything else portions of Indie Week. How Daniel Levin Learned to Want Yellow. When Durham musician Daniel Levin performs Walls Fall Between Player and Instrument, Music and Sound, Public and Private, he's a big guy who plays a big cello with his whole body, less holding the instrument than locked in a mutual embrace as they move together like dance partners. He has all the fancy double stops and string crossings you'd expect in a trained classical musician, but he will also produce homely squeaks from the wooden body, or strike the end pin on the floor, or cease playing entirely to swish his bow in the air. When he returns to the strings, his eyes will close, his mouth will open, and his head will fall back as he sinks within himself, deeper than we can fully follow. He's making it up as he goes along. Levin's many albums over the past two decades mark him as, quote, one of the cello's most brilliant contemporary practitioners, according to The Wire. Which is like Rolling Stone for people who left conservatory yearning to be free. Lately, he's become a local magnet for the scattered scene, connecting it with others, especially dance. Beside his own performances, he hosts Saturday Series, an intimate salon for local and international musicians, movers, and poets, at his home in the East Durham suburbs. The event series grew out of a pandemic collaboration with Duke University and has continued as a nonprofit. In its 35th edition on December the 7th, coming up, features a guitarist, a flutist, and two dancers. But with capacity limited and only available by RSVP, a better bet to see Levin perform might be a Shadowbox Studio in event on December 11, when Levin will be joined by Duke dance professor Barbara Dickinson. He also leads the Roaming Improvisers Lab with dance artist Ginger Wag, where dancers and musicians are split into pairs to create, discuss, and refine spontaneous works. The most memorable moment of last month's lab was when Levin, at Dickinson's prompting, sort of speared her with the cello as she lay on the floor. By day, he's the arts director at Durham Charter School, where he teaches the orchestra. He explains, "I'm trying to create what I had at Walnut Hill, but for free, in a public school setting. There's this overlap I'm experiencing right now between presenting, producing, doing the improvisation work, and the education side." Now, Walnut Hill is the arts high school outside of Boston, where Levin began on a traditional classical track. He came from a musical family, and when he was six, his mom asked if he wanted to play something. He said yes, cello, because he liked the low notes. It was just such a rich world to swim around in emotionally and psychologically, he says. Schubert, Beethoven, Mendelssohn, the intimacy of it. But already he was glimpsing something else in the music's cracks. During his senior year, he began to experience strange audiovisual phenomena, such as playing long, open tones and seeing a yellow chamber spreading like an artery through his arm. It changed him. He says it was like, wait a minute, it's not about the goal of making the sounds, it's about what making the sound does to me, Levin says. Accepted at two prestigious music colleges in New York, he chose Manas over Juilliard because he wanted to study with the cellist Paul Tobias. After a year at Manas, at an arts festival in Florida, Levin got his first chance to improvise with a dancer, something he'd never done. He says, "It was wild to watch this dancer and not be sure what I should be doing. I remember at the end she was spinning. Okay, I'll just kind of mimic that, so way up high, trilling. Then I had this feeling like she's going to hit the mat. That information coming from who knows where. So I fly down," he makes a sound like a dive bomber, "to the lowest note, see, and she slammed onto the mat." These kinds of experiences were pushing him away from written scores toward using the cello as something between an inner dowsing rod and a form of ESP. Instead of going back to Manas, he spent some time as a bike messenger before obtaining a jazz studies degree from the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston, under the tutelage of mentors like Joe Maneri. And he says a lot of this has to do with Joe. As soon as I went to his class, I was like, oh, this is it. It was all about using the music to go to transcendent places and being grounded in a technical rigor. But when I started trying to create my own music, I sucked at it. And I wasn't prepared to suck at anything to do with cello, but I had to. It took me many years to do something like Invite the Space Bach Has and not get stuck there. He's invoking not Bach the dead composer, but Bach the living musician, who could captivate an audience at the keyboard on command. It's not that Levin stopped playing those treasured suites. He says, "I think I'm going to be in a nursing home playing them." He simply stopped playing them in public. Instead, after graduating, he plunged into New York clubs, playing gigs at the Knitting Factory and CBGB with his quartet, usually cello, trumpet, vibraphone, and bass. The music was still color-coded. He would see four interdependent entities, calling them a kinesthetic sculpture vibrating in a room, yellow, red, blue, and green. He says, metaphor is really helpful for me in general. I remember being a kid and playing with Legos, how tactile that is. There's this searching motion and vibration. Sometimes you know what you're looking for, but sometimes you're just sorting and something pops up. It's a yellow square. Okay, now I want a little guy, some wheels, and a radar dish. No, I don't like that. Start over. And he concludes, I realized I needed to apply that to improvising. When I first started, I was like, well, would Joe Morris, that's another mentor at NAC, like this? But you're not neurotic when you're a kid and play with Legos. It's a space of casual and but decisive choices. Should I put yellow? No, I want yellow. Read article. I'm happy to be able to read some more music in the comparative dearth of hard news in this week's Indie Week. And this one is about downtown Raleigh rock club, Kings. It's a small club that has long served as one of the Triangle's most thoughtfully programmed and most steadfastly adventurous listening rooms. It celebrated its 25th anniversary earlier this month. But the club actually hit the quarter-century mark last July. Herbie Abernathy, a.k.a. Valiant himself, the lead singer of extraterrestrial theme Triangle metal mainstay Valiant Thor, and his business partners Mike Howell and Josh and Alan Novicki, bought the club from longtime stewards Paul Seiler and Chidi Kumar last October. When the big anniversary came around, they weren't yet in a place to celebrate. Abernathy says, we were so busy, we just said, let's push it to where we can make it to where we all have time to do something. Part of the busyness had to do with the other businesses Abernathy and Josh Novicki operate. These Richmond-based business partners have a pair of establishments in that Virginia city, Cobra Cabana, a heavy stoner bar food joint and venue, and Hot for Pizza, a Van Halen-themed pizzeria. They also have a seafood bar and venue in the Wilmington area at Carolina Beach called the Sand Spur. And they're actively working to open another bar in Richmond, along with a small listening room in a space behind the Cobra Cabana. But the demands of their other businesses weren't the only reason why the King's anniversary celebration had to wait until November. Up till last fall, the Raleigh Club, with a capacity of 250, had sat mostly dormant since the onset of the pandemic, only opening for some parties during the annual Hopscotch Music Festival and a smattering of other special events. Getting the club back into a rhythm, hosting multiple shows and events each week, and getting the word out that the room was rocking and rolling again has taken considerable effort. Abernathy says, it's being closed for a while during the pandemic, a lot of the business went to other venues. Nature abhors a vacuum, so shows went to other venues. There's a lot of competition. In 1999, Seiler, alongside Ben Barwick and Steve Popson, brought Kings to a building on McDowell Street. That building was eventually leveled in 2007 to make way for a parking garage. Back then, the rock club landscape was much different than it is today. The Pinhook in Durham, Cat's Cradle Backroom in Carrboro, two similarly sized rooms that booked similar acts, weren't even around yet. When King's reopened its current upstairs place on Martin Street in 2010, it was able to reclaim its place in the local venue scene. The last year has been about reclaiming that place once again. Abernathy says, when Paul, Ben, and Steve opened Kings, there was a need for a place downtown in Raleigh. Now Raleigh's different. But while the market may be more crowded now than it was 25 years ago, Abernathy still believes there is a need for Kings. Kings was an incredible spot, he says, of the role it played in him starting up bands while in college at East Carolina University. He and his friends would come to large clubs like Cat's Cradle to see big acts like Flaming Lips, but it was in rooms like Kings they found greater musical variety and proof they might be able to make a real go at pursuing music. And Abernathy recalls, our friends' bands who were a little bit older than us, the guys who already had it together, people we respected like Drag Strip Syndicate and Cherry Valence and the Loners and even the Greensboro bands, they were all playing at different places. And there was this new place called Kings, and we had a band called Lo-Fi Conspiracy, and they were the first ones that gave us a chance before we turned into Valiant Thor. One of the strengths that has historically set Kings apart in the Triangle is the breadth of styles incorporated into its attentively booked programming, spanning various shades of indie rock, metal, hip-hop, and experimental music, among others. Maintaining this variety and opportunities for up-and-coming locals remains an emphasis, but it means having to adapt. The draw of indie rock isn't as reliable as it once was, says Abernathy, and the crowd doesn't drink as much as it has in the past, eroding bar sales that are crucial to the club's bottom line. But things like jam-leaning bands and newer strains of hip-hop are showing gains. Adapting to these audience trends isn't just about generating revenue. It's necessary to maintain King's role as a hub to explore what's fresh and exciting among the local and national underground. It's stuff we would jokingly call bleep bloop music there for a while. It's just stuff I have no idea how to do, he says, laughing at how far removed he is from some of the hip-hop and electronic music King's books. I'm not booking the room for my ears anymore. You got to think about what the kids want to hear. Well, my background music is telling me that even if I wanted to hear more, I have to close up Indie Week for this broadcast. John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service is going to bid you farewell, and we will be back now recording next Thursday. This program, like others, is kept in our podcast section on ncreadingservice.com, .org, excuse me, and we hope you'll pay us a visit. Bye-bye.